Now it looks like we do have both counsel back and Judges Bradfold and Cochran joining me. Judge Sleater, welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is the second of our two oral hearings we have today, both in the usual fashion recently as virtual. We have non-oral matters that we'll be considering after this matter as well. And for both counsel's benefit, and I see you both have your audio muted right now. That's good. And we do ask that you keep it muted, obviously only when you're not talking. It does benefit our technology a bit, and the judges will do the same thing. If you have any difficulty during the hearing with hearing or seeing us taking part in any way, we'll let the marshal know to stop the clock. You should see the clock. Are you both able to see the clock in one of the boxes? Right now it's at 15 minutes. If you can nod your head, you're both very good. Okay. If you have difficulty with that, let us know, and we can also give you an update with regard to that. As I say, what we'll do is stop the proceeding. If for some reason we lose audio, we can't hear what you're saying. Otherwise, the process will be the typical, in that the appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes, respondent's counsel 15 minutes, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal. These proceedings are recorded, so we do ask that you identify yourself when you begin your statements for the record. And this is a reminder to all parties and participants and any other guests who are observing that our court rules prohibit any other recording in any method. So we appreciate that as well. And I'll note for the record that this matter now before us is in re the estate of Vernon G. Engelkes. A19-1950 is our file number. And counsel for appellant, as soon as you are ready, you may identify yourself and proceed. You'll have to unmute as well, of course.
Thank you, Judge Sleater. My name is Bill Wettering, counsel for my client, the appellant Mark Engelkes, and may it please the court. Good morning to the bench and to Mr. Malone. And I would like to just begin this by saying that this is a rather unusual type of case, at least in my experience, and from what I've been involved in with other counsel, it's an unusual case where their experience is concerned. Certainly the idea of a will contest is not unusual. It's the circumstances surrounding this one that make it so unusual. And the situation, I think, bears some commentary. We're here on an appeal after an admission to probate of the will following a trial on the objection maintained by the children of the decedent. And several of those settled out, and one child continued on with the case. There were four children. Now, I fully understand the burden that we have here. We have to show that the trial court erred and that there's clear and convincing proof that the error occurred and certain findings, and that in order for the court to reverse or make these additional findings, they have to believe that it's highly probable and clear and convincing and so forth. So what I want to first do is just talk about what the court did find. The court did find that there was a confidential relationship between the testator and the ultimate beneficiary of the will. The court did find that that same person had opportunity to influence the testator. So now the court has identified, and most of us are aware of these throughout the years, but the primary case is Wilson, and the court identified these six considerations that the court is to look at to determine whether or not there's an undue influence. So he did find opportunity, and he did find a confidential relationship. So that's found below. What happened, though, is he kind of demurred on the balance of the factors, of which there are four more, And he didn't really find, he just said that the court said that the objector failed to prove these other factors. And I would put to the court that that's entirely incorrect, and it's clear that it's incorrect. So I want to go over them. The remaining factors are that there was active participation in the preparation of the will by the party exercising the influence, that there was disinheritance of the family members who the were the natural beneficiaries of the decedent's estate, that there was singularity in the provision of the will, and that the exercise of influence or persuasion induced the testator. So,
I don't mean to interrupt your discussion of the Wilson factors, because I think, you know, that's certainly the heart of this appeal.
Sure.
But I want to pause for just a minute with your overarching premise, and it's in your brief as well, that the district court didn't make findings of disinheritance and didn't make findings of singularity. So the disinheritance piece, you're right that when the judge discusses the seven Wilson factors, the judge does not dwell or make a specific reference to disinheritance. But there are, in this very long opinion by the district court judge, we have several clear statements from the judge that indicates that Mr. Engelkes did disinherit his four adult children. I mean, the judge recognizes the disinheritance. So I think you got that, and the judge finds it. That's not an error. The same with singularity, and I'm not so sure I know what singularity means, but if it means that there is a single benefit to this particular beneficiary, here we have a sole beneficiary, you know, the judge clearly finds that too. I mean, that's in the opinion. So then to me, that real crux of the case is active participation and then whether there was the exercise of undue influence. So if we could just kind of jump to one of those two, that would help me in my consideration, unless I've got something wrong about the opinion on those other two points.
Judge, I think you're precisely right. There's no doubt that there was disinheritance and no doubt that there was a singularity of the provision of the will. But he didn't, as far as my reading of it, he says that we met those two and not the others. I'm glad that you see it differently. So that means,
well, I don't think that stops the analysis, because mm-hmm. the judge, when it got to factor number six, the exercise, the judge very specifically makes findings about the disinheritance. I mean, the judge finds that Mr. Engelkes intentionally disinherited his children because of this very sad history of family estrangement, and that basically he had no relationship with his children and he did it intentionally, and you haven't challenged his capacity on appeal, so he did it with capacity. So to me, that's what I'd like to have you talk about, is if we view the evidence favorable to the district court's findings, he's got findings that explain the disinheritance and the singularity of the will. So help me out there.
All right. I'm going in this direction that these are factors that the prior courts have determined that if you have these things, then they are evidence of undue influence. And so that's where I'm going with that. I realize that the family had difficulty over the years. And the only issue on the circumstance, when you say, well, I haven't challenged capacity, the cases have found capacity even when there's folks that are suffering from dementia and so forth. So I realize that that's not something that is going to be a winner. My point of bringing it up and talking about the decline of this man over the years and during the time after that decline started where he made this will has to do with his susceptibility to undue influence and the exercise of it. And so that's the only reason that I bring up this issue of capacity. And we went over in our brief some of the activities and things that this fellow did from just prior to 2012, when he had assaulted his wife and had an order for protection against him, and was removed from the home and weapons taken away from him and things of that nature. And then he got into this dispute with his wife that resulted in their 51-year marriage coming to an end, and that ultimately he was diagnosed with a severe case of dementia that the diagnosis was made later on. What I'm saying is that during that time, Ben, he was going to his bank and seeing the teller at that bank and spending all this time with this teller. And the time, you know, my view of it is that is where the undue influence occurred, and that the teller was made aware of his circumstances, his plight, whether real or imagined, his state of mind regarding the relationship with his children and his spouse. And certainly, I realize that counsel will make the argument, well, you know, his children took the mother's side in the divorce and left him hanging out there, and so he was angry at them and all that. I understand that. But then when someone else comes in and makes suggestions then to him or participates in the making of a will then that deprives his heirs, his children, of his property, that's where I think that it's clear that this went on. And the reason that I think that it's different than a friend or intimate relationship or something like that is that it's a person that works at the bank that he goes to, a person that knows.
So one of the points you make, Mr. Wetterling, in your brief, and I just like a follow up, a legal point, is exactly what you're talking about here, that because of the confidential relationship that the district court did find based on their banking, the nature of Ms. Chapa's relationship to the Mr. Anglicus as his bank teller, she was privy to some confidential financial information. And so you're arguing that creates some kind of an inference of undue influence. What do you think is your best case saying that this court, you know, obviously that's an inference the judge could have taken from the evidence. You gave a lot of good evidence to show what you're arguing. The judge could have drawn that inference, but he didn't. Yeah. So on what basis would you give us as an appellate court the ability to draw an inference that the district court didn't draw?
I don't think that, well, first of all, the judge said, well, I put great weight on the attorney making the will that thought he was okay and all the rest. Well, that doesn't weigh in on the influence. If you read the attorney's transcript of her testimony, she indicates that she didn't know him at all, didn't know his history, didn't know Ms. Chapa, and had no idea of all these other things that had occurred and made the will that way. I don't know where, when the judge says, I'm relying greatly on that, I understand that he may well have had capacity. People with capacity are still subject to undue influence. So my best argument on this, and what I think's been ignored, and what I think just, I find, I can't ever get my arms around or get around this fact. And that is that here you have a person who knows that the customer's going through problems. They're kind and friendly and conversational with the customer because that's their job. The customer then starts to believe that they've developed this friendship and relationship and then confides in about what has happened and has his side of the story about everything. And all she needs to do is confirm to him, yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, you're being treated poorly. She doesn't know that there's a harassment restraining order against him. She doesn't know that he's assaulted his wife. She doesn't know of all the things that his condition as he's gotten deeper into this situation that have caused family members to take a side against him, but she can capitalize on it. And here's how you know that that's what happened, because look into the heart of the matter here. Look into the heart of it. And that is that she's precluded from taking gifts in her job. And if none of us are children here, we all can see that when you go to your bank, your doctor, whatever the case may be, there is a confidential professional relationship there. The bank has rules against their tellers and their employees taking gifts from customers. And then
I'm aware, based on your brief, how you argue that bank gift policy, and that obviously was a contested issue. There's a lot of testimony about it. And Ms. Chapa did address that in her testimony. I did read through that, both all of the examinations. So one of the comments that she makes, and you quote some of it in the brief, she says, well, she didn't think of it as a gift because she didn't actually get money. You know, we can all set that aside for a second. To me, what was her strongest response is that the only time she talked to Mr. Engelkes about his will was before he drafted it. Even if you say that she helped him write out, fill in the blank on the will information form, she's very clear she never actually saw the will. And we have a big time gap here from the time that the will was executed and the time that Mr. Engelkes died. So obviously he could have changed his will at any point. She didn't know what the will said. So well, now that was contested. I get that. But that's my point to you on appeal. We don't weigh the evidence. That's what the judge does.
The
judge heard all of that and he ruled against you. So what are we to do?
Well, I understand, but I think it's clear and convincing. A quote from the Rexigel case that says, clear and convincing proof will be shown where the truth of the facts asserted is highly probable. I mean, to me, it doesn't take a great deal of leaping to see what's gone on here and see where someone has abused their position, abused their knowledge of the plight of a person, and again, we don't have anyone else to testify about it because it's conversations between the two of them. She's been reprimanded for the time spent with this fellow. She's done these different things, setting up the appointment with the attorney, someone that wasn't his attorney, takes him outside of the realm of people that are familiar with him, prepares the inputs so that her name is spelled correctly for her being the beneficiary, goes further with naming her children as the subsequent beneficiary should something happen to her, and then continues grooming him for the next several years until he does ultimately get sick and die. And during that whole time, that relationship, whatever business thing, continues on, and then totally acts surprised when this is the result of it. It's clear, I believe, it's got to be clear to the court. I thought it would be clear to Judge Moore that what had gone on here. You know, it's one thing to disinherit one or two children that you have a difficulty with. That happens all the time. And those cases usually are upheld. But where you disinherit your entire family after a situation like this, and then the person that is involved in it just acts like, well, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know.
Mr. Wettering, I'm going to interrupt. I believe you did answer Judge Bradfield's question. Of course, you'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal if there's anything further with regard to that or in response to Mr. Berlin. No, that's fine. I wanted you to complete your answer to Judge Bradfield's question. And Mr. Malone, you now have 15 minutes. You'll have to unmute yourself. And when you're ready to proceed, you may identify yourself and so proceed.
Am I unmuted, Judge?
You are correctly. We can hear you. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, my name is Paul Malone. I'm a lawyer for Doreen Chapa, respondent in this matter. First of all, just a couple of comments here. My Mr. Wettering at the end of his argument about the grooming and the coaching at or whatever it is that he claims that Ms. Chapa did. The evidence, I think, was clear. If you look at Mark Eidland and the others, the teller positions were close together. They could hear each other speaking. All but maybe two or more conversations at the bank were at the teller window where everything could be overheard. Those tellers weren't called. And so to figure out that somehow she's grooming him and shining him up and misleading him while you have other tellers there who could have been called as witnesses who weren't, it's just dreaming it up. They called Ms. Thiesfeld. Ms. Thiesfeld was a loan processor. She had an office. She wasn't a teller. She started working a month before the will was the first meeting with Attorney Eisma. And Judge Moore, in addressing Ms. Thiesfeld, asked when she approached the bank president about the conversations that Doreen Chapin was having with the decedent. And she indicated that was after he'd passed, which was about 3.5 years after the will was drafted. So the city to be grooming or misleading him or taking advantage of him with a number of other tellers listening, it's inconsistent with the facts. Now, with respect to this case, I'll go back to the beginning, excuse me. There's no question the burden of proof on an objector to the will, it's their burden. They got to prove the will was either the product of undue influence or incapacity. They got to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. When you review the facts, you have to find that the judge's findings were clearly erroneous, manifestly palpable, and palpably contrary to the evidence. And obviously, Judge Moore had 3 days to listen to everybody testify. And he's the one in the best position to evaluate credibility. And Judge Moore, in his opinion, did address all the factors, made specific mention of them.
So, Mr. Malone, just as I mentioned to Mr. Wetterling, one of the things I'm trying to do is zero in on some of the disputed factors. So, and I think one of the disputed ones is Ms. Chapa's active participation in preparation of the will. Certainly that's a big part of the appellant's brief. And we have very few findings from the district court judge on that, you know, even though I think, you know, you tell me your take on Ms. Chapa's testimony, but it seems to me that she at least says that it's possible or likely that the handwriting is hers. She doesn't remember, she says, she doesn't remember the will information sheet, but she does say that it's likely that the handwriting's hers or possible, something like that. And that will information sheet, you know, comes right out and says what we eventually see in the will, which is that she's going to be the sole beneficiary and all of the children are disinherited. So help me out there. Isn't that something that the district court judge should have, first of all, recognized, you know, made some findings, and then secondly, discussed whether that shows undue influence?
Okay. I believe you correctly stated that she indicated that could be her writing. I think the judge addressed that primarily with respect to Jennifer Eisma, the attorney's testimony. And the testimony was that on the first visit, and only the first visit, which was kind of an introductory visit where she didn't know the purpose, and she gave him the will sheet. Mr. Engelkiss left then and came back with that sheet, but then he came back by himself. And she sat there in her testimony. She explains how she talked to him about his competency, about why he was giving it to kids. He had some fairly extensive conversation. So although she was there and introduced him, after that, her active participation was very limited. And there was two more visits, the one visit for discussion and preparation of the will, and the next visit to sign power of attorney, healthcare directive, and the will with a number of other people present. So he had about a 2 or 3 month period of time where Doreen Chapin wasn't present or involved, and the matter was addressed privately with Mr. Engelkiss until he told his family what he was doing when the will was signed. I tried to answer.
Mr. Malone, can I follow up on that just a little bit with regard to the confidential relationship? And my question is, from your viewpoint, do you believe the court properly applied what appears to be from the Norlander case and the subsequent case law that there seems to be no dispute that there was a confidential relationship. But once that occurs, both factors such as active participation, and I would say that usually I suspect in a case like this where the ultimate beneficiary goes to the initial lawyer to sign a will, it would be a red flag. But when you've got it combined with a confidential relationship, did the court properly consider in its conclusions the phrase, I think, is a lessening of the burden as it relates to those factors, all of the factors?
Well, I think he said that you take them all and you consider the totality of the circumstances and weigh them all together. And with the kind, and I guess there's never been a very good definition in the cases of confidential relationship. You can be a doctor, a lawyer that's met with them every day for years, or a bank teller where you're visiting with them when you're overheard. And so the degree of the confidential relationship, I think, can vary greatly. And I haven't seen anything that really clearly defined that. Don't know if I answered your question. I kind of wandered off, Judge.
I think so. But you're satisfied that the court properly applied the Norlander, at least the case law, in terms of all of the factors given the confidential relationship?
Yes, he says so. He says he addressed them all and considered the totality of the circumstances. And I think critical in these cases is a disinheritance of those who would probably be remembered. And again, that's, as Judge Redfield pointed out, the family relationship here was not what we hope for in life. And, you have a confidential relationship and then you have an unexpected disinheritance. Well, I've argued and submitted, Your Honor, that these kids drug their dad into court about 3 months before this and fought over their brother's flag and machinery and lost. So you drag your daddy into court and try to take stuff away from him and then wonder why the will got changed or why you weren't left in the will. And I think here you would expect to be disinherited in those circumstances. And that's kind of a harsh thing to say, but when you start dragging your folks into court, it's kind of a harsh situation. And then they also, as sometimes happens, sided with the mother. And so the one daughter hadn't seen dad from 2012 to 2016. And so you have the confidential relationship, but you also have to consider the disinheritance of those who probably remember it. And I think that's a huge issue because of the way they treated their dad and the dysfunctional relationship, or whatever you want to call it, but it sure wasn't a very good relationship. And so Jennifer Eisma met him once with Doreen Chapa present, doesn't remember any input from Doreen Chapa, and then met two more times. And the consistent disposition where the sister-in-law says he said he wasn't going to give anything to his kids. He made a will where he didn't give it to his kids. He had the brother and sister-in-law present. Ms. Eisma read it to him. So it wasn't being hidden. It was well known he wasn't giving it to him. And so it was an expected disinheritance, not an unexpected disinheritance. So we have a confidential relationship that is not, it's, again, I don't know how you grade confidential relationships and how you get your pastor, you have everybody, but this was a relationship where it was overheard, the conversation was heard. And
Mr. Malone, if I could just follow up a bit on this question of a confidential relationship. So I get what you're saying. You know, attorneys certainly have a quite a special confidential relationship with their clients. But here we do have a bank teller where her conduct was governed by a bank gift policy, right? And, you know, when she's cross-examined about that at the trial, she's very candid and says, well, you know, I didn't think of this as a violation of the gift policy because there was no money exchanging hands. But when there's a follow-up question and she's asked just generally, doesn't this sound like a violation for a bank teller to, you know that the one of their customers to whom, you know, they have access to information is now going to give you their entire estate once he passes away. Doesn't that sound like a gift to you? And she says, yeah, you know, she says, yeah, it does. But of course, she never told her boss about her conversations with Mr. Anglicus. She never disclosed to the bank that he was planning on making her his sole beneficiary. So, you know, did she violate the gift policy? And how does that impact our analysis of the case? Yeah,
I kind of think it's a red herring myself. You know, it doesn't control what happens. He says he's going to make a will. She doesn't see it. And whether the bank has a policy, you know, what she's supposed to come in and say, well, maybe this guy's going to give me something in his will. Maybe, maybe not. And she received no present interest or present gift. She got along with a guy. And Mark Ivan, the bank president, said that they did cooperate and try to provide community services and make referrals and stuff and help people. So that's all consistent. And at that
Mr. Malone, I'm sorry, go ahead. This is Judge Cochran. I didn't mean to interrupt. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. So help me understand, though, why wouldn't a violation of the gift policy be evidence of an exercise of influence or undue influence, you know, given that she's basically not telling anyone about this potential gift and her knowledge of the gift policy? Doesn't that do more than give rise to a suspicion of undue influence?
Well, first of all, she didn't necessarily think it was a violation, and suspicion alone, as Judge Moore pointed out, it doesn't prove a case. And so if she should go in and talk to him, I don't quite know what the relationship with Mr. Ivan was between Doreen and the bank president. And when she should go in and talk to him about maybe somebody's going to give me something in the future. So I suppose somebody could argue would give a suspicion, but I don't see how it's a violation. And the facts weren't developed enough, or there wasn't no more evidence put in regarding when they're supposed to come in and when they're supposed to report.
Thank you.
Yeah. I did, you know, with respect to with Jennifer Eisma, who the counsel in the brief argued the judge improperly gave a lot of weight to her testimony. You know, Mr. Malthers took her deposition, and, you know, Mr. Wettering didn't participate in that deposition. And so her testimony wasn't subject to cross-examination from the current objector. But again, Ms. Eisma, attorney in 10 years, spent a good deal of time explaining how she saw it and how she discussed this with this man and how he suggested his disposition, which, given all the facts in this case, I think it's all entirely consistent. Judge Moore seemed to cover it. He made a lot of findings. He covered all the factors. He said he considered the totality of the circumstances. He heard it all, and he made his decision, and it's certainly not clearly erroneous. And other than that, I don't have a lot to say.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Malone. Unless there's any other questions, it doesn't look like it, then very well. We will turn it over, and when the clock will be set with 5 minutes, Mr. Wettering, so that you'll be able to respond. But I'm going to pose a question right here off to the start, because I want to flip the question that Judges Bradfield and Cochran have. Let's assume, Mr. Wettering, that Ms. Chapa, being hyper, let's use prudent, and even assuming, as the court found, there was no evidence she knew what would be in the will, she informs Mr. Ivland, you know, I know this policy. I just want you to know I drove him to the lawyer. I don't know what's in it, but just in case, I just want you to know about it. How would that have made a difference in the factual findings by the court as to whether there was undue influence? And I thought I saw his answer to that question anyway, Mr. Ivland, at least that didn't seem to violate bank policy. But let's assume she told him. What difference would that have made in the confidential relationship or the factors?
Well, I think that would have been brought to light at that point, and the bank could have addressed that with regard to her employment. You know, obviously they have those situations in place for a reason. That person and all her contacts with this man, that was as a representative of the bank. It was not as a friend. It was not as an acquaintance. They had no prior knowledge of each other. I mean, this is part of what kind of shocks me about this. is that I guess no one's as excited as I am about the idea that this could go on and that we could be sitting here now with the bank teller having been now being the sole heir of an elderly person's estate under the facts and circumstances as we've described them. That it just, because I do believe there would have been consequences on the part of the bank. And although none have been taken, and certainly, you know, the bank has counsel here, it was against policy, and it's against policy for a reason. A bank doesn't, she understood, and Mr. Ivlin testified about it, that the reason you have that is so that you have the confidence of your customers and their families. And I think
even assuming it's against bank policy, I guess my question is, how does that affect our review of a court's decision and the conclusion ultimately of whether undue influence? In other words, I assume there could be a scenario where she's fired and still has not exerted undue influence, but because of the bank policy.
I think it goes to her state of mind. And I think it's evidence, as kind of was pointed out by your other sitting judges there, that there's some idea that, you know, what I'm doing is wrong. I'm not disclosing it. And then I'm going to act surprised when it comes about. And all of these things play into her credibility. And it's just not, I can't for the life of me believe that anyone could find that credible under the circumstances of the policy, the feigning surprise, and saying, I did nothing wrong. Mr. Malone wants to make a point about how, well, other tellers would have heard them talking about this. Well, did other tellers hear them talking about making an appointment for him at an attorney that he doesn't know, guiding him away from the attorney that comes to the bank who he had done business with before, suggesting, you know, someone totally that doesn't know anything about this situation? Does that, no other teller heard about that either. And so all we have to go on is these little things where she can't help but tell the truth to some degree about, well, that he suggested he wanted to leave property. Mr. Ivlin and Ms. Thiesfeld both testified. If someone said that to them, to one of their employees, they would expect the employee to say, well, now that's nice and I'm glad you like me and all that, but that's not appropriate. I work for the bank and you know, I wouldn't be able to accept that. Her answer to our questions about that was, well, you do what you want to do, Vernon. After he suggests that, you know, and that didn't come just out of the blue. And so I just wrote this down as a thing that's bothered you. You decide for yourself. The intersection of the contestant's burden of proof and the proponent's confidential relationship must provide footing for meeting the burden of persuasion. The courts talk about, well, I've got the burden of proof, but once I establish the confidential relationship, in all the other cases on confidential relationship, there's kind of a shifting. But the statute basically says, I still have the burden, but where's any evidence from anybody but the attorney who just met the guy of how this all developed? And it's just not there. And there has to be somewhere where the court looks at this globally and say, we can't have this. This can't be the law and this can't happen. If you go back to all the cases that talk about these things, it might go over a little bit here, but you know, the courts have said, well, opportunity alone isn't enough. That was Weber versus Anderson. And then they said, participation alone is not conclusive. And that's in Rexegel, where the daughter contacted her father's own attorney, not some other person. And then they said that a confidential relationship between blood relatives negates rather than proves undue influence. So the opposite must be true.
If you would, Mr. Wedinger, you're right. Your time did expire, but if you want to summarize, you may do that at this time.
Well, what I'm saying here is that there's plenty of cases where you have one or two of these elements, but not several. And then, as we started out with Judge Bratvold, she was talking about, okay, what about the exercise? The questions of your panel has shown that that is the exercise. You have the ear of this guy. He's there. He's a customer. You don't have any other relationship with him. And then, and it's against policy, you don't inform anybody, and then you act like you're the most surprised person on the planet when this comes about after you have written in and participated due to your confidential relationship, written in the name of the sole beneficiary to for him to give to the attorney. I just think this case has to be reversed. Every single factor on undue influence has been shown at trial. And I believe the court should be reversed and these findings be made. And I realize it's a heavy lifting, and I appreciate your time and allowing me to go on. And thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to appear before this court.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and the briefing that you've submitted to us. We will be taking the matter under advisement, issuing a ruling within a 90-day period. We hope you both have a good day, and thank you for your patience and the technology. It worked well, it appears.
It was enjoyable. Thank you.